Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Paul Thiel, president of Thiel Tech Consulting. Paul is a noted expert in research and development for the information and communication technology sector. Paul, thank you for coming in today and sharing your insights with the audience.
Thank you, Stephen. I look forward to the interview.
How would you describe yourself, Paul?
I would describe myself as I've always had a strong interest and enjoyed science throughout my career, and my career is focused mainly on being a facilitator of innovation, mainly in the areas of applied research.
You just finished a role with BCIT. What were the three most productive examples of your work and the important lessons you wish to share with other executives?
It was my first experience in an academic environment, and BCIT is an applied research area, so there was a good fit. I guess my major accomplishment was we built a very strong team, internationally recognized in the area of industrial cybersecurity, and that's a very timely topic, and I think an area that's going to grow rapidly over the next few years. Another area that we worked on very successfully, I attracted in excess of a $1 million advanced computer set up from the federal government, National Research Council, funded these across Canada, and it was the first one that was focused towards commercial bioinformatics, and that was very successful until the federal government looked at their whole program and decided to get out of that business because the United States and Europe in particular, their equivalent facilities, they were putting much more money into it, and of course the users in Canada could use those. So that was a very interesting and foray into bioinformatics. I guess the other overriding thing that I think I did a good job of at BCIT was focused on research that could be commercialized. We did a lot of work in several areas in the IT area that is going to turn in the future into commercial products, I'm quite certain.
Are you able to discuss some of these commercial areas in a little bit more detail, perhaps one example?
I guess in industrial cybersecurity, again, we did a lot of research for international companies and became very clear that we needed a test platform that could emulate a hacker and do this very effectively, and we have developed a platform that is in the process of being licensed to a spin-off company. And I think in the future, if it doesn't set the standard, other ones very much like it will. And but that's certainly an area that is very intense right now in the amount of research that's going on in it. It's very quiet because it's being done by national labs. And but it's by industrial cybersecurity, of course, what I'm talking about is security of systems like power lines and pipelines, et cetera, that are controlled by computers now that need to be very closely monitored and set up to be very tight from cybersecurity attacks.
Paul, do you have another example to share?
I guess the area of computer-based training is certainly of large interest. By that, it's really using multimedia to teach areas that can't be taught well through conventional classroom settings, etc. And one of the chaps there, I think, has been working on it for many years and has written a definitive book on it. But basically, encouraging the use of the web and DVD-based training in a way that incorporates the best of teaching methods and the best of what's available in multimedia as a training tool. You can't use these systems very well as page turners. You know, you just don't put your book into it and use it as a page turner. You have to do it so you can mix things like games and other things into it that allow it to be a real learning experience. So your outcomes are much better than you could do it any other way.
Which areas of the industry or technologies would you consider high risk versus medium risk And what would be your advice to companies about these areas?
The high-risk areas, in my mind, in applied research, are trying to take on the large install base, you know, the Microsofts of the world. You don't try to do that, it's very high risk to do that successfully. So I guess what I think a really high risk is if you are going to go into an area where you're going to displace incumbents that are very settled. The medium risk areas that we go into is where you can develop products that complement and extend the installed base so that you're not trying to displace an installed base, you are complementing it and extending it. And there's a lot of areas in there that are very fruitful.
Paul, can you give me some examples of what you would consider a medium risk ventures?
Obviously, areas, and I'll go back to the computer-based training things, those are areas that you are complementing what's being done in the colleges, the universities, and in the public school systems. And the professors will use these tools as a tool to augment their present teaching techniques, but it doesn't displace them. So that's certainly one good example. And then, you know, basically in a lot of the wireless, I'll talk more later about microelectronics, but in those areas, there are add-ons that you can give to systems that will make them much more effective. And it's, you know, it's simple things like Bluetooth. And for instance, the iPod now, Steve Jobs announced a few days ago, he's going to have a wireless connection where once you buy the film from him, the video that they're now going to be producing in that environment for iPods, you can download it to your TV. So there's a box coming out for a few $100 that will do that. It's those sort of areas that you can pick up on and do very well if you have the best product and are first to market, or want to say first, one of the first to market.
Paul, you are a founding member of the Canadian Microelectronics Consortium. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes. Back in, I have to think about this, about 1982 in there somewhere, it became very clear that microelectronics, that is the integrated circuits, were going to change the way we did everything. And if the prototype costs at the time were very, very high, you know, in the order of $50,000 to get your first prototype. Canadian Microelectronics Corp was formed, and it was part of the federal government. The NSERC funded it. We made the proposal to put a central facility in Canada that would provide the tools and the training for university students to build, to do designs in microelectronics and then build prototypes at a much reduced cost, 10 to 100 or times. It certainly typically was 40, 50 times cheaper. That is, we put 40 or 50 chips on one design on one wafer. So the cost of developing that wafer, which was, you know, $100,000, we'll say, was divided across 40, 50, up to 100 different projects. And I guess I could add that CMC is still a very viable business. It's been going over 20 years. So it was a very good move by the people that founded it to do this. It's really allowed microelectronic design in Canada and the Nortels and all these people. Most of their engineers that they got had been trained on these systems.
As senior technology advisor with the BC provincial government, what case scenarios provided the most challenges?
There were sort of two parts to my job. One was helping local industry, and one was trying to write a science and technology mandate for the province. The biggest problems that we had was trying to convince the government, that is the politicians, that high tech was a very good investment, and that was something that they should give some attention to. So the biggest problem we had was selling the politicians on high tech. It's not it's very difficult to cut a ribbon and make a big announcement. It takes several years for high tech to prove you've invested in the right thing. And so, again, the biggest problem was convincing them that in their typical four-year mandate that they could get some political goodwill out of it.
How do you foresee the build-out of wireless technologies?
It's everybody has been looking for the big hit, the home run hit, for quite a few years. I think it will continue to build out in a fairly controlled and smooth manner. However, it's very clear to me and everybody else that the advent of, and again we get back to microelectronics and the single chip cell phone and all these things, the ability to have wireless devices that are low cost, low power, and can be used anywhere, any place. Obviously, people don't enjoy being tethered to a landline or to their computer. It's much better if you can move around. So I guess the build-out will occur in PDAs and laptops and devices that can be hooked in wireless through Wi-Fi sites and the WiMAX type of environments. So it's going to be a continual build-out. I guess I mentioned Steve Jobs earlier with his announcements that from the iPod, that download will be a wireless connection to the computer, the set-top that he was talking about. It's not hardwired anymore. It's all wireless. It's just an example.
What are the major challenges with IP telecom, and how will they be solved?
Many of them are being solved now, and it's moving quite quickly. But the biggest problem is quality of service, of course. People are accustomed to, in the landline, to having access 99.999, you know, 3, 4, 5 nines of service. They, in the past, with cell phones, basically, if you make 100 calls and 2 drop, you think you're doing very well. If you did that in the landline, you'd be very upset with your service. So the biggest problem, I guess, with IP will be the quality of service that, people have learned to expect on existing lines. And the next item, of course, I said earlier, that microelectronic chips are, the power usage is coming down, but of course the power required is going up in PDAs and everything else. So backup power is a bit, when I say backup power, longer power life is going to be a big issue, and that has to be solved through whether it's some type of fuel cell or, some method there. But the amount of hours you can get out of your device is still a limiting factor.
What are the implications of service-oriented architecture and the integration of systems from factory to line of business?
Obviously, to me, there's two major items there. It's a great concept, and I think it'll come a long ways, but the first item is cybersecurity again, security. How do you secure your programs are running on all sorts of different platforms from, and you don't know where it's coming from, et cetera. So you have to have a very secure system. That obviously is a big issue. And the other one that I am not an expert on this, but obviously there's a tremendous amount of handshaking going on while this is occurring. So those protocols that you'll need to do that are going to have to exchange a lot of messages, and that could become, I think, a limiting factor on how cost effective it is.
Forecast the 5 most interesting new technologies and the opportunities they represent.
Obviously, there's a lot of them out there, and probably if I'm right on 2 or 3 out of the 5, obviously I'll be fortunate, but it's a forecast. So video on demand, or video, again, I go back to the iPod. Video is I've worked on video for the last 20 years. And we had a living room of the future at Microtel Pacific Research in the mid-80s, and we showed how you downloaded on demand all of the, if you wanted to look at Top Gun movie, which was one of the ones we used, and, you know, the high-definition TV. All these things now, and again, I think it's very clear with the new iPod, with its higher resolution and all that, the video is going to become affordable, and we know that communications is about 80% visual. And so there's no question that although cell phones and text messaging and everything works wonderfully well, if it's cost-effective and available, video, I think, is going to be a large item. So I see that one as being a very significant growth area, and will help productivity and communications. The GPS systems that, you know, the last few years have come way down in price and people are using in the cars and all that, I think that's another area that people are going to use, want to say marketing, and you'll see, I'll use the term yellow pages, but you'll have the ability, if you want to buy a wheelbarrow or, you know, a new car or something, you'll be able to punch into a database what you're looking for and your location, and they will tell you, the system will tell you, just like Yellow Pages used to, where you can go buy that, and that will get extended, I think, to where there's pricing and everything available. So if you're buying a small or large ticket item, you'll be able to put it in and find out where it's available and at what price quite quickly. So I think there's a significant area there. That time is money to people, and if you know, you know, where, who's got inventory and all that, which is being integrated now into a lot of the corporate databases and in stores, inventory databases, etc. So I think that's a big area. The other area that I mentioned earlier is fuel cells. I think the alternate energy, just because, you know, it has to be green in the future, but for the IT industry, there's got to be some way of allowing us to have more than 2 hours on our iPods or whatever, and or even your cell phones now, if you use them, they're great. They're 14 days if you don't use them, but if you use them a lot, you know, obviously the batteries go down. So I think there's an area there of alternate power that's a big area, and will get integrated in. Probably the largest area is nanotechnology, and that just covers every aspect of society, whether, you know, it's new materials, whether it's biotechnology and the use of it in there. Nanotech, I think, will have the highest payback in the biotech area, but it's going to have tremendous payback in all other areas. And I guess I'm probably the service-oriented architecture, I think, is one that is going to be very, very significant. You know, that there obviously are problems to overcome, but I think that's going to... The present programs we have on computers now are just too big and there's too many holes. I think if you divide it up with service-oriented architecture, I believe that's an area that's going to grow quite significantly also.
What do you hope to accomplish in the future, and how do you plan to go about doing this?
Probably at the age where I should be retiring, but I don't think that I'm going to, in terms of what I hope to accomplish in the future. I am a founding member of the BC Nanotech Association, and we have some pretty big plans for BC and Canada in those areas. But I guess what it, from a personal point of view, I just hope I can, you know, continue to help facilitate innovation. What I've learned in life, I guess, is innovation and new products typically just don't come out of the blue. It's a very slow process, but a very pragmatic process that generates these things. And in the past, I've been able to help people cooperate and, you know, facilitate that interaction that helps that innovation. So I certainly plan on continuing that.
What motivated you to get your MBA, and which areas from your MBA do you find the most relevant and useful?
That was a big decision for me. I was taking my master's in electrical and computer science, and I all of a sudden realized that my skill sets were more as a facilitator, and if I was going to go down that route, I needed to understand people better. I needed to understand, you know, business aspects, writing the business plans and the financial and everything. So essentially what motivated me was when I looked at where I wanted to be 10, 15 years ahead, I wanted to be in management. I wanted to be in a position where I could help steer things and make it happen. So that's why I switched and took an MBA. And I guess the biggest thing I got out of the MBA was both through the classroom theory and probably 50% through the people I worked with. There were a lot of senior managers that were in their 40s and 50s, and I had just turned 30, I guess, when I started it. So it basically became a very wonderful place to learn about how people interact and what motivates people. So that's the largest thing I got out of it, I think, was how to be a better facilitator.
What do you consider to be the 5 most useful resources and why?
Obviously, the web is, to me, is the most wonderful resource. It has allowed people to do research much faster, to collaborate a lot better, and it's a wonderful resource that's going to continue to get better. So that would obviously be my first one. The second one is networks. People are everything, and, you know, the separation of 6. If you have a good network and you have, you know, interest, whether it's marketing or technical or questions that you need answered, the web is a wonderful place to go, but you don't get that same sort of feedback, I guess is perhaps the word, and interpretation of what's happening. So the personal network is huge in my estimation, and it also makes your life a little bit more complete. You have to organize all this, and I guess PDAs and the calendars we have on our Outlook and Lotus Notes, etc., and on our PDAs, I've used Palm for years, and that is a tool that is very, very useful in helping to organize our life and keep track of things. So it's sort of at a personal level, that's a big thing. And, you know, obviously, one of the big items that maybe should be right at the front is that, again, at a personal level, is family support. If you are fortunate and have people around you that understand why you're doing what you're doing and help you. Obviously, the IT industry, I think most people work 12, 14 hours a day. And so that support in the family is huge. And last but not least, obviously, the whole telecom network, whether you call it the web or what you call it, but the ability to use a phone, the ability to go to blog sites, to do all these things, that has just revolutionized how the world has worked, and I hope it works both in science and politics, but it certainly has been wonderful in science.
What are your views then about Web 2, this sort of social interaction that's occurring worldwide in communities and through blogs and wikis and Flickr and so forth? What are your views on all of that?
It's wonderful, and I think in the schools, you know, people have to learn to question the answers they get. You know, obviously a good marketing person can be very convincing, and, you know, we appreciate that in all our homes we probably have goods and services that we don't really need, but somebody convinced us it was a good thing to do. So there, you know, it's a two-edged sword. I have grandchildren now, and I watch how they interact with the web, and it's just wonderful. It's quite amazing. But I think their parents are doing a good job of making sure that the children understand, you know, what they're looking at and what they're doing. So, obviously it's going to happen. We have to, try to keep people aware that they question and that we're not lemmings that walk to the, you know, follow each other to the sea. So, good and bad, but on average, it's very, very good. And I think that, it will evolve into something that I'm hopeful will help the world solve the political problems.
Because of your involvement in things like research and development and trying to take it to business or to commercialization in some way, what do you really see as some of the most serious challenges for business today and into the future?
The most serious challenge, I think, for business is understanding what I said earlier about the high risk and the low risk, but understanding where they can make the difference and how to apply the technology, I guess, is really what it amounts to. There's going to be a lot of changes, and a lot of people, industries that, you know, were very, very viable and worked well, and the telecom industry is probably one of them, and I think they're changing. I think they're going to meet because they're aware of it, but you just look at, there's only really two institutions that have stayed throughout the world, and universities are one, and religious institutes are the second, that really are unchanged, in so many words, for the last 1,000 years. But even those are going to change, but I guess what I'm saying, the standard industry, whether it's the car industry or all these, they have to really understand how IT can be applied and what the people want. And again, looking at youth and how they do things, I'm finding that with my grandchildren, it's quite amazing how many messages I think are there for future business.
You have services that are available within many of the search engines and portals, and really communications is somewhat freely offered now through the internet, and many other services are now being freely offered in different forms. How is the telecom industry going to survive this?
It's a good question. I mean, obviously, if you look at the fact that long distance used to be their main revenue generator, and everything else was subsidized by long distance. Well, that's gone now. Everything's being subsidized by wireless. And I think, you know, the telecom industry will survive. Whether they do it, I mean, ringtones, I suppose, is an example. They're making their money off ringtones. Who would have thought, you know, that that was more money than providing a service? So they're going to have to find new ways of, and it's back to what I say, looking at what the young people are doing and how they're using tools and what they're willing to pay for, obviously, in the end. But that's where they're going to have to make the money. They won't make the money off. I mean, you know, as you said, Houston and cities like that are looking at putting Wi-Fi throughout the whole center. So, you know, what is the incumbent telecom going to support? You know, service providers, the cables or the telecoms, what are they going to provide if that's done by the city free? So, good point, but as I say, I think ringtones and some of those revenue generators are what's going to keep the telcos going. When I say ringtones, the equivalent of ringtones, whatever that new thing is.
You know, when I think about productivity in Canada and we lag other countries, and are attributing this to ICT adoption. What are your thoughts on this?
Yes, I think there's no question, you know, I guess our tax laws are being changed, but people are not motivated to put in the latest equipment in the sawmills, in their plants. And the sawmills during the softwood lumber, I think, was a very good example. Canada had to step up, modernize, or die. And they did. And they modernized their plants to a large extent. And the same in all the other industries. The productivity can only be caught up with if, you know, if people apply IT and robotics and nanotechnology or whatever to the highest degree. For our standard of living, we have to be producing products and that are have high margins, or you know we can't retain our standard of living. So it's very important that Canada and that understand. And again, that was my time with the on that secondment with the provincial government, with the politicians. They don't fully understand, most of them, what this could lead to, and it's just a matter of keeping pressure on them.
This is a little bit sort of a side question in a sense. It's not really technology based, but which international and Canadian figures do you admire?
Well, it's interesting. I guess I always liked Bill Clinton, and now when I watch what he's trying to do and how much Hillary's involved, but Hillary and Bill Clinton, I think, understood the world scene, and so from a social and political point of view, it was there. I'm quite impressed, and of course, with the AIDS thing, and not to overpass Bill Gates. I think Gates is a very, very smart man, and he's doing his thing now with his foundation, which is just wonderful. So, you know, those two are big ones in my mind at this point. And on the other side of that coin, the David Suzuki Society, I think, is a wonderful balance. I mean, he's very scientific. He's a very good marketer. And I think he's doing a wonderful thing for Canada and the world to try to keep our environment acceptable.
Throughout your long career, describe three events that had the most profound impact on your life.
I guess I go back to people for at least one of those, and perhaps two. When I first graduated with my BSc in electrical engineering, electronics, the first person I worked for was a wonderful PhD that had escaped out of Budapest, out of Hungary, during the Hungarian Revolution in 56, and came to Canada. But he was just a wonderful scientist, but he had music and understood people, and he was probably the most well-rounded person. You know, he understood the relationships between science and people and all this. So he was a wonderful mentor. So that was obviously, he had a very large impact on my life, and he augmented my parents. I guess my parents were very supportive of my interest in science, but this man was just the proof of the pudding and was just a great guy. Another person I worked with was an engineering physics master's, and he understands everything he does essentially down to molecules. And that insight and that sort of knowledge, we were doing microelectronics and other things together, and he would question, and he had a very large impact in my life. And I guess the last part was I was fortunate enough, I guess, to be working with those sort of people and interested when microelectronics, when the integrated circuit essentially was invented and first became a reality where you were making 1,000 transistors and a chip, and now we're into the tens of hundreds of millions. But the microelectronic revolution had a very significant impact on how I saw things and where things went. And I guess the biggest impact in that whole thing was a textbook by Carver Mead and Lynn Conway called The Silicon Compiler that would have come out in the early 80s, as I recall, and it really shaped what Intel and everybody else, how they designed chips and how computers got their role in life in the chips when they said silicon compiler. Up to that point, chips were laid out by hand, and, you know, it was handcrafted. It was a very tedious job, and as I said, you could do maybe 1,000 chips or up to 10,000 transistors per chip. this allowed the whole thing to go into the millions and, you know, has spawned what is now the microelectronics, the integrated circuit industry. But that one book changed things almost overnight in terms of how people thought and how far the horizons of microelectronics could go.
If there were sort of an opportunity to just sort of comment about just anything off the top of your head, it could be social issues with regard to technology, governmental issues, international challenges. Perhaps you can share some thoughts on this.
It's interesting. Day before yesterday, whenever on the 11th of September, of course, we all thought about 9/11 in 2001 and what impact that had on us. And of course, the cybersecurity and all these industries that have had to be generated from that, and they would have had to be done anyhow, I think. But obviously, that has had a big impact. And I was involved a little bit, and my daughter was in Montreal with 17 years ago when the Cole Polytechnique shootings occurred. And for these shootings yesterday again, it leads back a little bit to the question of, are we marginalizing some people that can't fit into this high tech, this environment? We'll find out who that chap was that did what he did yesterday in Montreal, but we have to be more cognizant of the people around us and get more community again. I think we'll find that there were people that knew this lad was very upset and whatever happened. The community aspect, and I'm hoping that the blogs and all these things can have a positive effect on that. So again, I think, as a species, we need community, we need friends, and we need to make sure that no one's left out completely. It's very easy to put your headset on and look at a video and not worry about the person next to you, but I think we have to get back to recognizing that we need a very strong community around us, and we have to help those people that are different than us, that don't fit the norm, fit in, because they have things to offer. And I guess from a philosophical point of view, I think we need to do a better job of helping our neighbors.
Paul, what are your passions, the things that you do for relaxation perhaps, or what are your hobbies?
It's interesting. Family and friends are the biggest thing. I certainly read some. I wouldn't say a lot, but I try to read some of the non-technical books. I read a lot of technical things. I've the outdoors. I like walking. We like camping. There's things like that. I'm going to spend my Thanksgiving with my brother out in the foothills of Alberta and a bunch of his friends who go out and take horses and go back in the bush and to heating rocks. They'll make a pit and cook the turkey in the pit like people did years ago. But it's kind of getting back to your roots from time to time to ground you is certainly one of my relaxation things.
What's your favorite gadget?
I guess it's interesting. I was without a cell phone for 3 days. I couldn't figure out, what to do. So you have that. The PDAs and the cell phones are certainly what allow you to keep in touch with your friends and keep that network going.
Well, Paul, thank you for taking the time to do this interview and sharing your experiences and deep insights with the audience.
You're very welcome, Stephen. We'll look forward to whatever comments and what comes out of it, but it was an opportunity for me, I guess, to reflect on things, which, again, is something, as I say, about helping neighbors and that. It's the sort of thing one should do more of. Quiet moments of reflection are very satisfying.